This is The Conversation. It's episode 199 with Matt Starr. So close to 200. Can you believe it? He is a New York-based artist of many different activities. The title describes what he does. He's given himself is conceptual comedian, and some of his projects include Amazon Boy, where he cruised around Manhattan as a Amazon delivery person with a stack of boxes on his back going nowhere in particular, and getting into all kinds of interactions. There's the I'm Sorry bus stop project, I'm Sorry to various entities. And another great one is Baby Core, the Baby Core project, where he made handmade couture that came from his baby days for adults. So we talk about that and so many more things. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast where you can check out those projects and more is theconversationpod.com. If you're new, welcome. Let me know you're new. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also check out past episodes, including a fantastic 198 episode with Jimmy Dams, a gallerist also in New York. That was pretty epic. So if you haven't heard that, definitely check it out. You can also support the show there financially. More on that on the back end. But we could definitely use some support because it's a listener-supported show. Matt is what I love, among other things, about talking to Matt, which is holds true for the person who introduced us, Grayson Earle, is that he is an artist making art in New York, but he's not in the sort of what I sometimes refer to as the art world proper, which I guess is a kind of a way of saying the market art world, the news art world. The news that Matt has generated, I believe, has been in sort of a slightly different forum or platform. It's been social media news, and it's been fashion news and other kinds of news, other than sort of art news, hyperallergic type news. So great stuff to look forward to. Before we get there, just a couple of things. One is, as I record, we're leading into the weekend of the big opening September activity at galleries, museums, art institutions of other kinds. I did a little math, and there are in the neighborhood of 50 galleries opening this Saturday alone here in LA. And these are all serious galleries. I'm not including, you know, sort of off the beaten track schlock type stuff. And that's just this Saturday. So there's going to be more Sunday, there's going to be more next weekend, and so on. So there is a lot going on. So plenty of opportunities for FOMO, fear of missing out, to come for me and all of you as well, right? Other thing I wanted to let you give you a heads up about on the back end, I just read this great book about a long-haul mover in the moving part of the trucking industry, so personal moves. And there was a great anecdote in it involving a one percenter and art, and that was enough for me. So I'm going to read that passage to you on the back end with a musical accompaniment. So I hope it is tasty and enjoyable for you. So that's something coming up on the back end. Now let's get to the conversation with Matt Starr. Thank you guys very much for being here. I appreciate it, and stick around on the back end for more. Is Starr your given name?
Yes, it's always been Matt Starr. I was born with it, and I love it. It's one of the few things I really love about myself.
Right, it's one of the few gifts you were given. Right, otherwise you're like me, you're a self-hating Jew, I guess. Right.
to say that, that's an understatement.
All right. Well,
but you know, that might come along with making things, constant self-doubt, and
yeah.
You know.
Right. Good. Nice save there. Nice save. So you're in Manhattan. You're in the financial district, right? From what we spoke about before. Yeah. How long have you been there?
So I've been here about 2 months. I've lived in Brooklyn I mean, all over Brooklyn for 5 years. And my best friend was like, hey, I got an extra bedroom, come and move in with me. And I've been here for, 2 months, and 2 blocks from the water. It's really wonderful.
Wow. And so I want to deconstruct how, a little bit more about why and how you're there. Your friend, is he about your age?
Yeah, he's my best friend. He's 28, and we've been best friends for 13 years.
How did he get this place?
So, I mean, he's a normal person. He has a great job. It pays well. It's 5 days a week. So he can afford to live in a place like this.
Right. You just set off a bit of a mini hand grenade when you said normal person.
I know. That's all right.
Yeah,
he has a quote unquote normal lifestyle.
Yeah, right. But I mean,
speaking.
But even for just I mean, maybe I'm being totally naive here, but even for a 28-year-old with a normal job, to be able to afford an apartment in New York City, or especially Manhattan. I mean, Manhattan in some cases is cheaper than Brooklyn. I've talked about that before, but that's not an easy thing. I mean, did he get a find, or is this like a market rate place?
No, this is more or less a market rate place, but he's been here for 5 years, and the market in the financial district, like most places in Manhattan, has only gone up. But after 9/11, the prices dropped significantly. So he moved in when they were just starting to build it up. So he got a really good rate.
Right.
And I guess it's not so normal, but he works very hard and he's been able to afford, this is the lifestyle he wants, and it's a lifestyle he can afford right now. So.
And what does he do, since we're talking so much about him?
He's a producer.
What kind of producer?
He does commercials. He works with Harry Potter and Disney and big clients like that.
How do you get to be a producer at that young?
He never went to college. He has been working nonstop and self-sufficient since he was, I would say, 15.
Wow. That's a lot to measure up to as a best friend.
Yeah, but, he really takes care of me. Before I didn't get into art and to making stuff until I was 22. And he's been, he was with me before art, and he's been watching my career through every project, and he's definitely been one of my biggest supports.
That's nice. So sort of like a sugar daddy best friend kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that. That's nice. Yeah, I think my girlfriend and partner and parents would also see him as a little bit of a sugar daddy.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, he's a little bit of a best friend sugar daddy, and he really believes in what I'm trying to do. So
right.
It's been mutually beneficial.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess he's going to be able to own all your YouTube videos and whatnot at some point.
Yeah. Well, that and, these like weird poems I write, he has them hung up all over the wall, and other like paraphernalia from a lot of my performances he has in the apartment.
Wow. That's a really nice bond. I mean, being that you have a lot of self-doubt like I do, one of the thoughts that just sprung into my head was, wow, if you guys got into a big, really big fight, that could be disastrous for your career.
Yeah, it would be awful. But so far, so good.
Yeah, right. So you're in this place in the financial district, which your sugar daddy best friend, has you set up with. He's got the lease, right? It's he doesn't own it. It's a rental?
Yeah, it's just a rental.
Right, got it. Okay. Is it a two-bedroom?
It's a two-bedroom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, that would be really funky if it was a one-bedroom.
Right. Well, it's not unheard of, certainly, in New York. But so what has it been like living in... I mean, it's only been a couple months, but what has it been like living in Manhattan after living in Brooklyn for a while?
Well, I was just telling my girlfriend about this. It's weird because I'm so comfortable. I don't want to leave the apartment. I've always lived in these little shoe boxes. And I got used to that, and living in these shoe boxes, it really forced me out of my apartment. I hated being in there. I had a twin size bed for 5 years. I had cut out windows, and that was kind of miserable. I mean, it was miserable.
What's a cut out window?
So it was like a room inside of an apartment. So it wasn't a real window. So
oh,
like,
I see.
The rooms were built in these big lofts,
right?
And they cut out. Like the light was coming from light from the apartment versus light from outside, or it was the light from outside that was lighting the apartment that was coming into my room, and that was miserable, and it was claustrophobic. So when I woke up, I I would go on a big run, and then I would stay out for the rest of the day.
Right. And now you're homebound.
Then now I love being here.
Yeah.
We're going down to the water. It's really nice.
That's great. That's great. And what about your being an artist and the artist community, if you will? Do you feel like you're to some extent divorced from that because most of those people are in Brooklyn, or is that not necessarily the case?
Even to be honest, even when I was in Brooklyn, I've always felt divorced from the artist community. I've never really felt part of any community in New York. You know, I have some good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of people who support me, but I've never fit in any of the crowds.
Right. You didn't go to art school, is that correct?
So I lived in Israel for a year, and then I went to Indiana, but I didn't go into school thinking I was going to do art. It happened 2 years in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then what happened after that?
I took these two courses, and it introduced me to a larger concept of what art was, and it really blew the lid off of it, and I was like, whoa.
Right.
I could do this stuff. I have stuff to say.
Yeah.
And from that point on, I got invited to be part of the a digital art BSA, and I just kept making stuff, and it hasn't stopped, and I've been on fire ever since.
So you got a BFA in digital art?
I ended up double majoring. I got a BSA, and then I created my own major.
From where?
From Indiana University.
Oh, okay. Okay. So
yeah.
The reason I'm asking about yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, being in Indiana, you know, I really hated it for the first 3 years. But then I would come back to New York, and everyone was freaking out and pulling their hair out who was going to art school or film school.
Right.
And I was like, man, this is not how I feel. Like, I felt great in Indiana. I was able to move at my own pace. I felt very little competition, and I was able to explore, you know, different mediums without, like, being yeah. stuck in one. That was really nice.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure there are pros and cons to both situations, but the thing that I was getting towards is that when you talked about feeling not really a part of any sort of group, is that you're both coming to art late, not necessarily that late, but you're coming to art relatively late, and you're also not coming to New York with a tribe, which is very much the case here in California and L.A. But as I'm sure it's also the case in New York too, is that people,
it's definitely the case here. I mean, yeah. I feel left out all the time.
Right.
I mean, all my friends have friends from school, and you know, it forced me to rely only on myself.
Sure.
I constantly tried to reach out to people, but it just, you know, I had some hits over the years, but I was never able to form a community.
Right. Yeah. And being a social media presence, right? Because your work leans very much into social media. Have you found a certain amount of satisfaction from that type of connection, both virtually and in person?
Definitely. I mean, a lot of my work, you know, I only like to make things in the public space now. That's where I get the most satisfaction. But I design it so it can exist on social media, and people share it and like it and whatnot. And people will reach out, and that's how I do get a lot of my jobs, is through social media.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of affirmation and money jobs come from social media at this point.
What kind of money jobs are we talking about?
So I did this thing called Amazon Boy about a year ago, and that was me creating an experimental delivery program for Amazon. I did that, and then I met this woman who started pitching that concept to other companies, and I was hired by this luggage company to do something similar. And it was me, basically. I had 80 pieces of luggage from this luggage company, and it was me waiting for a ride that never came. And I was on my way to Art Basel, and each luggage contained a piece of my art. So I would wait at these different hotels for rides, and they never came.
So there, selling their luggage, and they're using your creative angle of being an artist going to Art Basel, basically?
So basically, I mean, this is the most perfect thing I was ever a part of in New York and in my career. They said, we're going to give you this amount of money. You can kind of more or less do whatever you want. Just do something similar to that project Amazon Boy. And I never had a client that said, that gave me carte blanche, and they gave me carte blanche, and it was perfect. And they had people to help me. They had a production team to help me. And that happened because of social media. That happened because of the Amazon Boy project I did on my own.
Right. So this is advertising. You're basically, you're a creative, sort of a one-man creative team in advertising?
Yeah. A lot of people describe it like that.
Well, how would you describe it?
I mean, I call myself a conceptual comedian. Everywhere's a joke. Everything is a joke, but nobody knows what's the joke. It's really inspired. I'm really inspired by Andy Kaufman, and yeah, brands align themselves with me. So I guess, yeah, in a sense, it is advertising. But mm-hmm. when I'm conceptualizing, I'm not really thinking of advertising. I'm just thinking about creating an experience in the public space for people,
right.
You know, something that people will want to take a photo of, or people will say, what's going on here? You know, something to really challenge people's expectations.
Well, but what about the end game of the company, the corporate entity owning your creative product? Isn't that something that's part of the thought process at some point?
So a lot of the times, it's different for each company. I've normally worked with really small companies where we sign something off, or like, you know, they own the images, but I still own the work, so I can reproduce this in any way I want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
So I've really lucked out with the companies I've worked with so far.
Yeah. Well, why don't we try taking the Amazon Boy just as a quick example, just because that's the one I'm most familiar with, because I saw the couple of YouTube videos of that. And just for listeners mm-hmm. who haven't seen it yet, and they can go check it out, you know, through the conversationpod.com. But you're wearing a harness belt, you know, with a stack of Amazon boxes on your back. So it seems to the initial viewer like you are sort of spoofing Amazon, as you know, and delivery in general, as like you've got this sort of monumental series of packages that you're delivering that you can barely move through the city streets with. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, that sounds right. Yeah, I mean, it was never. You said spoofing or goofing?
Spoofing. With an S.
Yeah. I mean, I was never really looking to spoof anything. I was really interested in their drone program when it
right.
came out. And I
right.
thought that was crazy. I mean,
yeah.
I can't imagine drones flying all over New York. And I wanted to basically, I was also obsessed with these photos of people carrying things from various parts of Asia and Africa. And I thought, let me create a program for Amazon that retains a friendly face on the company as they launch their drone program. So I wasn't really trying to spoof anything. I was really trying to create a program to be as realistic as possible. So when I went out there, people really thought this was a program. I mean, it was really great PR. It was free PR for Amazon.
Yeah.
And I was looking to create a program that retained a friendly face for the company, because, you know, we take a lot of these companies and boxes for granted because they're pervasive and they're everywhere now. But I'm really interested in our emotional attachments to these companies, and I wanted to really put a face on this company, and that became Amazon Boy. And I walked all over Lower Manhattan, and people stopped me everywhere. I mean,
So speaking of putting a, you know, a positive face on it, what was the typical exchange with the people that you encountered like? I mean, I imagine, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to say one more thing. I imagine that most of it was the novelty of seeing this guy with his giant Tower of Amazon boxes on his back.
Definitely. Everybody stops me. People would stop me for photos, or people would stop me to ask what was going on. Some people thought it was advertising. A lot of people felt bad for me. People were like, how did they do this? They better be paying you so-and-so amount of money. And
uh-huh.
it was a really wide range of interactions. I met this, she was like an 80-year-old curator from the Met, and she followed me for 10 blocks,
mm-hmm.
sweating in the dead heat of the summer. And she just, you know, I think a lot of people didn't see the art in it, but a lot of people saw the struggle. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, I was drenched in sweat. I had a hunchback. By the end of the day, I looked like a turtle, and I was carrying 30 boxes. Nobody had any idea how much this weighed, but they could tell it weighed a lot.
Right.
So that was interesting, was that a lot of people saw the struggle and empathized with me. And some of the best interactions came from the other service workers, the other delivery men. They mm-hmm. would stop their cars. They would honk. They would stop me and talk with me.
Right.
I've had more intimate interactions and conversations as a service person and delivery boy than I have had at all, like doing anything in New York.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
What's interesting to me, as you describe that, is being a digital native, which I knew I was going to use the word digital native, and maybe at some point I'll use the word millennial as well. But being a digital native, it obviously makes sense that you would, as an artist, be using social media, you know, to a certain degree. You're using it to a quite large degree. But what is interesting, having heard you just describe that, is you obviously have taken a lot of satisfaction and inspiration from in-person interactions. And I guess maybe the question is, it's not like one is better than the other. I kind of anticipate your answer might be, but I mean, is it ultimately more artistically satisfying to do a live performance as opposed to something that is strictly for the web?
Let me just say something about performance, because I'm extremely awkward. I have severe ADD and it's hard for me to hold conversations. And I've tried improv and I'm just so awkward and I freeze up that, like, performance, you know, I know people use that word because that's what it looks like from the outside. But Amazon Voice, one person described it this way and it totally stuck with me and it totally solidified how I see this project. But Amazon Boy and what I do now and the stuff that I try to create, it's less about performing and it's more about being. That for Amazon Boy, I created the outfit, I matched the color, I had the logo, I had the boxes, and I really took on this role. And I walked around with, like, my list of addresses, and as anyone was concerned, I was delivering stuff, so I didn't really have to perform. But I guess that in and of itself is performing. But for me, in my head, I was just being, and I was just existing, and I was just walking. I was just me. In this outfit, being me and being Amazon Boy. So anything I did as Amazon Boy was Amazon Boy once I was in the outfit. But
right.
to answer your question, the stuff in real life is so much more satisfying because, you know, one thing that I'm obsessed with is risk. And I feel like something has to be at stake. And when I'm online, anybody can say anything. And it's just, it feels, you know, it falls short. But I have no idea. You have no idea when you're out there in the public space. You have no idea how somebody's going to interact with you, and you have no idea what they're going to do. Anybody at any point could have pushed me over. I wouldn't have been able to get up. Amazon Boy did cause car crashes. I can't go in thinking that that's going to happen. So for me, it's what I look for is to do something. It's for something to happen more than what I imagined it could be.
Yeah.
And what it would be. I just try to set up the environments that encourage this kind of chaos.
So if the great, you know, support and exchanges and the woman from the Med who followed you for 10 blocks were some of the highlights, were the car crashes that people got into because they saw you some of the lowlights?
I don't even want to go so far as to call it, what do you call it, the lowlight?
The lowlights, like the low point.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't low points because, like, to me, it's all art. It's all part of the experience.
Right.
I mean, yeah, obviously, like, everybody, you know, I wouldn't be saying this if somebody got killed, but it was real and it was intimate and it was chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because of my severe ADD, that's what I need. That's like the game I want to play.
Yeah.
And that's what I was looking for. I was looking to put myself out there, throw a pebble into the pond and see what happened. And there really was no low point. The low point was like going home and taking it off.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to go back to your sort of clarifying about, you know, that it wasn't performing, it was being, I didn't use the word performing just to clarify. I'm not trying to be defensive, but I just put the experience, I put the experience under the category of performance art, you know?
And I agree with that. Yeah. And I'm not like sensitive. To be honest, I like when different people have different ways of describing my art, because I have such hard times. I have such a hard time describing and codifying what it is I do.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't even care if you call it performance, but it did trigger something in me that I remember this person said, this is not a performance. You're just being, and whatever you do in this suit is what it is. It's part of you. And I always thought that was really interesting, and it recontextualized how I thought about this piece.
Who was this guy? Do you have any idea? Did you find out?
I know exactly who it was. It was a kid. I told you I took an improv class. I thought I was the worst in the class. This kid said I was one of the best, and we stayed in touch, and we caught up one time, and it was right when it was at the tail end. It was the tail end of the summer when I was finishing up the first year of Amazon Boy. And he was telling me about what he thought about it. And you know, he's an actor and he's a director. So he just broke it down for me, and I thought he was kind of spot on about that.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it really feels like, speaking of this guy and what he does, it feels a lot already from the 20 minutes or so that we've been talking, that, and this was clear from some of the projects that you've been working on that you told me about, that you are working in this fluid area around art, improv, film, you know, video, YouTube, et cetera. You know what I mean? It's like, I would hazard a guess that you, even though you use the terms like
conceptual comedian. I mean, I think that term's funny. I think it's not as limiting as other terms,
right?
Because nobody uses that term. So for me, it allows me to kind of continue to do like do whatever I want, I guess.
Really. Yeah.
I don't like to be boxed in. And that term doesn't really box me in.
Sure. Do you mind? I'm saying this with a lot of qualifiers, because I kind of am anticipating some of my listeners getting a little uncomfortable, but can we talk about your ADD for a moment?
Yeah. I mean, now is a better time than ever. I just found ADD coach. I just had a 3-hour meeting with an ADD coach. It's getting so bad.
Wow. So how long have you had it? And when you say extreme, how does that manifest?
I was diagnosed when I was 7. Mm-hmm. NBC did this. My dad actually just found this tape. NBC did this long piece on me when Adderall first came out, because they diagnosed me and they put me on Adderall. I've been on Adderall from 7 until almost exactly a year ago, and I've been off for about a year now. How does it manifest? I can't focus. I can't retain information because of my focus. So reading is just, you know, I love reading. I buy a lot of books, but I don't read a lot of books. It's really hard for me. So I read 3 pages. I have to read them 3 different times to actually get the information stuck in my head.
Right.
Social cues. I miss a lot of social cues because I'm thinking about 20 different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a lot more severe. I don't know since getting off the Adderall or just as I get older, and I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm lit up all the time. I want to make. I want to do, but I want to do 10 different things. So for me, it's just, that's why, you know, I've kind of done what I've done, because I'm just trying to get it out as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And why did you go off the Adderall a year ago?
It put me on edge all the time. It mm-hmm. suppressed my appetite, as I'm sure a lot of people know. And it just, I would wake up in the middle of the night and binge eat, and that was hard. I didn't like living like that. And I became dependent.
Right.
I don't like depending on things, because like right now I don't have health insurance and I can't afford Adderall. So what would I have done? So
is the coach helping?
I can't afford the coach. So he just gave me a free, they're expensive. He gave me one free, introductory meeting.
Right.
He gave me a lot of like organizational skills. It kind of helped, but I mean, it's hard, you know, ADD
sure.
is such a passe term that like, oh, you can't focus. But it's like, it really screws me up, and it screws my lifestyle up.
Yeah. That's, I'm sorry to hear that. Is there,
no, it's cool. But there's benefits to it. You know, I'm able to make the stuff that I make, and I'm able to think in the way that I'm able to think, and I'm able to take one idea from this area and take another idea from a totally different area, and I'm able to find some sort of parallels between them and create something totally new. I don't know if that's the ADD, but that's kind of what it's boiled down to for me now.
Well, one of the things I was wondering is there the ultimate activity performing, you know what I mean, happening that you could do that would best sort of mesh with your ADD? Or is it just as simple as, you know, when you're doing like Amazon Boy or anything else for that matter, where you're using a lot of different physical and mental things at the same time, that's basically all it takes?
I think that's exactly it for me.
Yeah.
It's putting myself out there. I told you I'm so attracted to risk and something feeling like it's at stake, because that's when I'm at my best. That's when, you know, I feel like I'm setting up these situations that force me and allow me to think quickly. And I'm at my best when I can think and speak quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm not good at improv when it's in a room, I'm really good at improv when I'm in real life.
Right. So I wonder who other than Andy Kaufman who does that? Who's the penultimate, ADD performer, if you will?
I don't know. I mean, I'm attracted to more people who probably don't have ADD, but
right.
You know, it's hard. I mean, I constantly look for people in the art world who get me off, but it's hard because I think because I didn't come up with art, I didn't really go to museums. I haven't really shown in galleries. I have no affinity for the art world per se. So, you know, there's something that I did a lot of when I was younger and still I do less of now. I watched a lot of TV and I watched a lot of films, and the goal is to continue making films. So filmmakers, I love Harmony Korine. I love Jean-Luc Godard. I just finished Buster Keaton's autobiography. I think right now I'm really into vaudeville Buster Keaton. I think these are people, they're performers, they're directors. They put their bodies at risk. They're improvisers.
Right.
So people like that are the people. Abbie Hoffman. I really like Abbie Hoffman.
Abbie Hoffman from the activist from the 60s?
Yeah, the activist, because his whole thing was about play and doing things at theater in the streets.
Right.
And then his
right.
whole thing was politics is life. So whatever he did was political intrinsically.
Yeah.
But there was always humor, because humor is disarming. And I thought that was, you know, that's inspired me a lot. John Waters is another example. He inspires
sure.
me a lot.
Do you know that Harmony Korine has been making paintings? And have you seen them?
I've seen his paintings. Yeah, and he talks a lot about, I mean, his paintings are, they're just everything. It's pain. It's whatever is in his circumference. I actually met him one time at one of his openings at the Gagosian.
Was it everything you had hoped it would be?
No. His paintings, you know, his paintings he does for himself, and it makes him a lot of money. But, I mean, they did nothing for me.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
It's everything I wasn't hoping for.
No, I actually meant meeting him. Was it everything you hoped it would be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was incredible.
Was he?
Yeah, he was incredible.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he was wearing this weird Fila, obscure Fila jacket that I had a surgery a long time ago, and my dad gave me his jacket, and I had to wear it because I couldn't move my arms, and Harmony was wearing the same one, and I saw it as a sign.
Yeah, right. Kinship. So speaking of film, you have been working on a film. You're a co-director with this woman, is that right?
Ellie, my partner Ellie Sachs and I, we decided to remake Annie Hall starring seniors, and our Woody Allen character is 94.
Yeah. And how old's the Annie Hall?
So the Annie Hall, she won't tell us. She's in between 70 and 80.
Okay.
But you know, we've gotten so close with our actors that we kind of stopped seeing their age. They're so youthful. It blows my mind how youthful they are. It's really incredible.
And so are you redoing the film word for word?
So I guess I'll just tell you how it started.
Sure.
My grandmother has Alzheimer's, or she had early onset Alzheimer's. And when I first saw her after a few years, or after a year with this, we had a really hard time engaging because she would forget, and she would ask me the same question over and over again, and it was really sad. So what I did was, when we got home, I put on a film for us, and she started saying the lines after the actor in the film,
mm-hmm.
and she started taking on these characters, and then I would take on the characters opposite her, and this became our the way we engaged and communicated with one another, and that was my point of access.
Right.
I came home and I met Ellie, and I told Ellie this, and Ellie facilitates in prisons, and she works in lower income communities, and I said, I want to do what I did with my grandmother on a larger scale, but I have no idea how. And she said, well, I do. So we started pitching it around to different senior centers, and this one called Lenox Neighborhood House on the Upper East Side, they said, this sounds great, just write us a proposal. A month later, we taught a class for 3 months, and we had such amazing students, and there were such amazing people in our class that we decided to do this on a lot larger of a scale. And we had all these people to donate their time
mm-hmm.
and their skills. So we worked every single weekend for 3 months, and we reshot it. It's a truncated version. There was some improvising as well, because, you know, we couldn't shoot the LA scenes. It was totally zero budget.
Right.
And we didn't shoot the exact interiors, but I would say 70 to 80% of the New York City exteriors are shot for shot and in original locations, which mm-hmm. was really amazing. We had some people who have been living on the Upper East Side for 30, 40 years who saw the original Annie Hall being shot come to us and tell us that they were there for the original, and we had this really great exchange.
Wow. What have you been shooting it on?
So we shot it on a Sony FS7, and we had a working DP, a working producer,
mm-hmm.
and we had all these professionals lend their time because they were so moved by the project.
Wow.
Yeah, we just had Jeff Garland. Our two leads were in a talent show, and Jeff Garland met them and became obsessed with them. And he says if we decide to do any reshoots, he promises to make a cameo.
Wow. And so
really amazing.
Where are you in the production phase at this point?
So right now we're doing an Indiegogo to raise money for editing.
Okay. So you've got it. You've got all the shots in the can.
We've got all the shots in the can.
Okay, so you just basically want to hire a professional editor team.
Yeah, we've had all these professionals already, and we mm-hmm. would really like to, bring it together. We also, I forgot to tell you, there's also a documentary being made about this whole thing too.
Oh wow!
We had a guy filming us for the past 5 months. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so it was presuming the editing gets done and, you know, the film gets finished. Do you see it as film festival type situation, or is it hard to say at this point?
So, you know, I don't know, because we don't want to get sued. You know, this originally started as mm-hmm. as a collaborative art project with a mm-hmm. senior center,
mm-hmm.
and it just ballooned into something a lot bigger. I think the documentary will and 100%. Will do the festival circuit. I know New York Times OpDocs is interested, as well as a few other outlets. But we recently met this Sundance Award-winning film director. He did this documentary Alive Inside, and we were connected with him, and he's really interested in turning the documentary into a feature. So,
mm-hmm.
so we don't know. I mean, the documentary it has a lot of options right now, but our film, I think we're looking to do some New York City premieres. I know I have a guy in Indiana who wants to screen it. I think I'm really looking to do the university circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So we go, we talk about the process of making this. We explain how to work within your communities and work with seniors and what seniors have to offer. That there's a lot more than just, you know, we can do a lot more with them than just like the standard art classes.
Right.
It totally, you know, after this, I thought the only relationships I had with seniors ahead of this was with my parents and with my grandparents. I never had a relationship outside of that type of relationship. But this experience with Shula and Harry and the other castmates totally redefined the type of relationships I can have with seniors. It was a really incredible experience.
So you're forming friendships with some of the seniors?
To say the least, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're on email every day. Shula calls either Ellie or I every other day. We go on double dates. We we go to the center and have lunch with them.
Wow.
We've formed a really close bond.
That's awesome. So what are some misnomers about seniors that young people might have that you would like to debunk?
Yeah, well, this is something we've been talking about a lot recently. You know, going into this, I was really nervous. We had a 94-year-old in 94-degree heat. You know, that type of heat is not safe for anyone. But we were really nervous. But this guy, he's been tap dancing since he was 5. He takes advanced tap now. He does advanced Zumba twice a week. He swims twice a week. I think one of the misnomers is just how active and how much more life there is once you reach a certain age, that the same issues we have now, they also have, that so many of our conversations are about relationships, about love, about sex. You know, the same conversations I have with my friends who are in their 20s and 30s, I have with my new friends who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I had no idea that was, like, we would be able to talk about these things with them.
So how are your friends in their 70s, 80s, and 90s finding partners? Are they using Tinder and whatnot?
No, we've talked with them about this, and they've heard about these things, but they don't use that. We thought about setting up some Instagrams for them, but no, they have all these community centers, and they go, and you know, there's a lot of, like, love triangles. There's a lot of drama that really, you know, surprised us.
Yeah,
but yeah, they all meet in these senior centers, or they're all these classes that they take. So they meet and they become very close.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, so being that you have this art project / film that's a remake of Woody Allen's classic with seniors, with older seniors in the starring roles, there's a lot of question about the legal issues about releasing it. Have you considered, you and or your partner consider doing a film about them that is original?
Yeah, well, that's our next project. So we're actually writing a script for the seniors that's totally, totally original.
Right.
There are some legal issues, but, you know, we're not making money off the film.
Mm-hmm.
This started as just a collaborative. I mean, it's art, you know. It's like, you know, I don't hate, but, you know, Richard Prince, this is like, it's a practice of people taking things and recontextualizing it. For us, you know, we chose Annie Hall because so much of Annie Hall is about memory and love, and it's New York centric. And we thought, what better of a film to choose? And again, we didn't think, going into the project, we were just going to shoot it on our phones. It was going to be a suited film, but it ballooned into something so much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, unlike a lot of other art, we're really not looking to make money off of it. We were just looking to create a meaningful experience for the seniors and for ourselves.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, moving forward, you know, we're in the writing process right now.
Interesting. Well, that sounds intriguing, and so of course does the Woody Allen one. You'll have to keep me posted on what kind of screening potential it has on the West Coast.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, but as we're talking about all these things, I have to admit that, for better or worse, this is an art podcast, and not to say that these projects aren't art, but one of the things that's kind of lingering in my mind is your sort of distant or maybe discomforting dynamic with the art world, coming into art late and making art that is sort of in its own universe and whatnot. So we could take this in a number of different directions. I guess the first maybe question off the top of my head about all that is, do you have any desire to get, say, I don't know, whether it's Amazon Boy or maybe, do you have any brick and mortar pieces that you've made that you would like to get into an art institution of some kind?
Yeah. You know, I'm happy we're talking about it because it's something I struggle with all the time. Just because I'm not in the quote unquote art world doesn't mean I don't want to. I mean, I see everything I do as art.
Sure.
So whether it's like I'm in the world or not, I'm in the universe of art. And, mm-hmm. I have this I'm Sorry project where I have a key. That it's a universal key for all the New York bus stops. where I open them up and I put in, I apologize from groups or organizations who refuse to or can't apologize. For example, I'm sorry from Wells Fargo. I'm sorry from plastic. I'm sorry from men.
Right.
And I put them in there. And to me, this project, they're huge. I hand paint and cut everything.
Mm-hmm.
These are things I would love to exist in a gallery or some sort of art space.
Right. Right.
I have these poems that I do. I also see those being in there. I see the Amazon boxes being in there. I just watched this thing on Warhol, and it's uncanny how similar the Amazon boxes are, and they're hand painted.
The Amazon boxes are hand painted.
Hand painted. Yeah, I didn't just use Amazon boxes.
Wow.
'Cause they say Amazon boy, so they're all hand painted.
Right.
But, anything I do, I can see being in an art space. But these specifically, I think would live really well in it. But I also think that I think for me, it's just I'm putting in my time right now, and I'm still carving out my voice and my space. And I think the way I've always thought about it since I started making art was that I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and what makes me happy, and eventually the art world will catch up and take me in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Grace and Earl, who introduced us, he himself mm-hmm. is operating in this sort of digital platform, performance out in the world kind of platform with projections and so on, and that's sort of, it's both art, but it's not part of the market art world, So in that sense,
mm-hmm,
you're not
mm-hmm,
alone.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back to the I'm sorry bus poster project. So how, because logistically speaking, so how did you get a universal key to the bus windows?
So there's another artist who is one of the most amazing artists I've ever met. His name's Jordan Saylor. He has a project called Public Ad Campaign, and mm-hmm. he creates functional art, which are these crude keys. And he has keys for all over the world, and he's I don't want to speak for him, but more or less he's anti-advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks these ads are projected into spaces where people aren't asking for them. So he gives out these keys to artists to replace these ads that people don't ask for, with art that we're not trying to sell anything. We're just trying to, add a little beauty to the public space. But for me, I was really inspired by Bernie Sanders. I wasn't just like art. I wasn't political. I couldn't tell you the difference between the right and the left. And then Bernie came along and he was kind of this gatekeeper, and he let me in and he said, this is how what's happening up here matters down here. And then I got into Abby Hoffman, and he taught me about how politics isn't just about who you vote for. Politics is life. It's what you eat. It's where you shop. It's how you treat people. And I wanted, and it all just came full circle with my art, that everything I do is about democracy. I don't look to make art just for galleries. I look to make art that's accessible to anybody, whether you're educated or not educated. And to me, I guess that's kind of how this I'm Sorry project came up. I saw an opportunity to do something that was overtly democratic and also political and also artistic. And I knew it would only last a few days because the people who manage these spaces check them. So they get taken down, but I know that they're provocative enough that people take pictures and post them. So a few of these campaigns have gone viral.
Right. So it's a guerrilla thing where you have to go in there late at night, open the thing, put in your thing.
No, it's the opposite. I go in during the day. Because that's when people, you just kind of have to mimic the motions of what's really going on. So these people who change out the ads, they go in during the day and they do it. So I put on a vest and I go in and I do it in broad daylight.
Right. One of those sort of orange, neon orange vest type things.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just
right.
had the publication Now This just followed me doing it. Wasn't a great interview though.
Sorry to hear
but,
that. But what about
yeah, okay.
what? What about when these pieces wind up online? Is there any attempt to bust you for these?
No
vandalisms,
nothing,
as it were.
I've had long conversations with Jordan and other artists,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the police have bigger fish to fry.
Right.
It would cost more money and time to come after me than I think is worth it. And that's kind of what it boils down to. But obviously, you know, it's protest art, and you have to be willing to put yourself on the line. And again, it comes back to risk and stake and chaos. And I think the message is more how the message and image is more powerful than me spending one night in jail or me getting a small fine or me doing some community service.
But you haven't had to do that. It's easier to say that now because you haven't had to do that yet, right?
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. So Jordan developed these keys he's developed the key for every city. Well, what's the story there?
Basically, he can more or less at this point reverse engineer anything. Mm-hmm. I think. I mean, I don't really know how it works. I just know that, I mean, there's a great interview online where he talks about these pieces. I mean, they're not just keys. They're functional art. I had a big Bernie Sanders art show that I put on, and I asked him to be in it. And I saw the keys themselves as art. And I think what the keys stand for is even more powerful.
Right. And do you feel like you got, other than sort of your, you know, likes on Instagram or what have you, do you feel like you got some interesting feedback from the Sorry posters?
Oh yeah. I mean, some of the most interesting feedback people, I mean, it really sparks a dialogue. Especially the one I did, I'm Sorry for Men, that's the one that went viral, and it was right after the election. So a lot of people, you know, I'm not here to whack people over the head and tell them what something means. I think that's belittling, but it's really, there's no branding on it. There's no, my Instagram's not on it. There's no hashtags. It just says I'm Sorry - Men.
Right.
So people really project what they want to on it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of men thought that I was apologizing on behalf of them for the election, which was fine. And a lot of women saw it as this is when Trump got elected and Hillary lost. So there was a lot of discussion about gender, and people were really upset. So it sparked a lot of dialogue in a lot of different communities.
Do you think that some people who saw those posters suspected that the creator was not a man?
I think from the conversations I've read online, I think most people thought it was coming from a man.
Okay. Interesting. Do you think your painterly handwriting is somehow reflects coming from a man or not necessarily?
You know, I've never thought about that.
Okay.
It's a really childish, you know, I have really childish handwriting.
I don't remember
so if
that
anything,
way.
I think people
I don't
really?
remember.
Oh,
that way.
It
yeah.
feels it feels childish to me. I don't know. Yeah, but it's, I guess, like, men's handwriting is not known for being
the cleanest. Yeah.
Pretty. So
right.
it's
right.
you know, it's, I guess people would look at it and be like, oh, it's like sloppy. It probably is a guy. I guess it does have like a boyish aesthetic.
Right. Of the pieces that you've done, of the work that you've done that we haven't talked about, what would you say has gotten the most traction? Been the most provocative?
I guess it was kind of provocative. I mean, it's weird to look back because it feels silly, but it was me reacting at the time. I did this piece called Baby Core it was a year or two when I moved to New York. Normcore had just become a thing. People were really into trends.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I was just really obsessed with were people's obsessions. And it was so interesting for me because I've had very few obsessions in my life. And it was really interesting for me to see how easily people became obsessed with things. So I, you know, humor to me is that is a universal access point. And I think it's like I said earlier, it's disarming, and you can have a real conversation when there's humor involved and you can get someone to laugh.
Yeah.
So I recreated my baby clothes in adult size, stitch for stitch, took these really nice photos. And this woman at Refinery 29 wrote about baby core as if it were a real, like, the next up and coming trend. And I woke that the next morning after that article came out, I woke up to 10 different outlets all over the world asking for interviews. And people were taking this very seriously. They were talking about adult babies. And it was me in a diaper. It was like me in more or less a diaper.
Right.
So this was,
That's awesome.
It was totally subversive, I guess, but it was also really silly. But it was so interesting how people don't, you know, at that time, people weren't really questioning anything. Nobody questioned who I was or where I came from or if people were actually doing this. I was the only person who I saw doing this. And I guess they thought I tapped into something. And it just, you know, the Today Show talked about it. The Nick website talked about it. BuzzFeed, and it just kept going and going and going. And I had, you know, the two demographics who reached out after that, I had hundreds of emails from young girls and much older men. And I always thought that was really interesting.
And what kind of things were they saying?
The girls would ask for the pieces, if the pieces were available for sale. The men would ask for more photos.
Were the pieces available for sale?
I had 10 of the originals, which I was selling as art objects, and they were really expensive. So nobody actually bought anything.
Oh, you mean because you priced them at such a rate that the people who were inquiring couldn't afford them?
They were like $400, $600 for like one sweater. But again, because it was written about it in a way as if this was a real trend, if I started this line, but really I just, again, threw this thing out there into the ether.
Yeah.
And people took it really seriously.
Right. That is the definition of a spoof, by the way, the word I used earlier in the conversation. So wait a second, just to clarify, because when you were describing these women and these young girls or tweens or whatever they were who were contacting you, I was picturing that they were inquiring about the photos that you had taken as art objects, but that they were actually inquiring about the objects.
Yeah, they wanted to buy the pieces. Yeah.
Right. And they weren't willing to fork out $400. That seemed worth it for an original for haute couture. Right.
for a Matt Star original. Nope.
That's harsh. Well, I feel like with that level of press, you could ask easily much more than that. No.
I could what?
You could ask for much more than that, more than $400 per.
I think so too. I think so too.
So you need a better dealer.
I need a dealer.
Yes, exactly. You know what? The one interesting thing that reminded me of and I did take a quick, I think I just saw one of the pictures that you had for this, but have you ever heard about this fetish that is, I'm not sure the exact name of it, but it's something like adult diaper fetish, where basically the fetish of the man is to be swaddled.
I got lots of emails and a lot of interview questions about that.
Like whether that was your thing,
but that was I'll be totally frank, that was not even in my foresight. I was not thinking about that. I was really only thinking about people being obsessed with normcore.
Right.
And I said to myself, what is the most absurd, and people were obsessed with nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to go as far back as I can without getting into the womb and create a trend from there.
Right.
How far back can I go? Like, how? Right. So baby clothes, it landed on baby clothes. And I thought baby clothes on adults was the most absurd thing at the time that I could think of. And that's kind of how it happened.
I don't know if this is totally, again, naive or absurd, but was there a window of opportunity when you got all this press around this piece for you to, if nothing else, be a consultant to a designer, fashion designer?
You know, people reached out, but I will say that, like, having gone viral at that magnitude, it taught me something, and it's that just because like you can get all this press, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
And now, I mean, even more, you know, the acceleration rate is to such a degree now that you have 100 different things going viral every day. So what does it even mean to go viral now?
Sure.
And having gone viral a few times over the past few years, I have to recalibrate that it's not, for me, it's not about going viral anymore. It's about creating these meaningful experiences.
Right.
And hopefully touching somebody that will want to give me another opportunity or yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I thought you go viral and that's kind of it. And you just keep getting opportunities and keep getting opportunities. And that wasn't what
well. That
happened.
That is to go back to earlier in the conversation. That is kind of what happened with the Amazon boy, right? Because you got an ad gig, for lack of a better description, out of it, right?
Yeah. That was a year ago. So I did Amazon boy, and a few months after that, I got a really big gig. But and then even yesterday, some really big fashion designer wanted to hire Amazon boy to walk on a runway. But they had no budget, and it just kind of fell short. So, I mean, I'm constantly straddling this. Like, I think I'm creating this really interesting work. I think, judging by how people talk about it online or people talk about it to me, people are interested, and it does create an impression on them. But I'm trying to figure out, how do I make money off my art? That's something I'm still struggling with.
Sure. I'm glad
the virality doesn't.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said no to the designer with no budget for the fashion show.
I wrote this poem a while ago, and I'll read it. It's two lines.
Sure.
And my poetry series is called This American Life. So This American Life. Nothing in life is free except my art.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. And it's crazy. That's how I feel. I mean,
yeah.
I've sacrificed so many comforts to continue making the weird stuff that I make. But it's just, I think I told you about this one project, famous artist looking for a job.
Yes.
That I had such little money left. I was really inspired by those posters that people, those tearaways that people put around saying, looking for a babysitter or looking for guitar lessons. So mine was a picture, it was color print. Famous artist looking, it said in big bold letters, famous artist looking for a job. I thought that would stop people. And I didn't want a 9-to-5, and my skill set is kind of, it just doesn't always equate to money jobs. So I thought I'll take whatever job that anyone is willing to give me. And to me, I was thinking about it artistically that this is art to me, that whatever menial job I get, I'll be doing it within the realm of art, so I can justify it to myself. And I got some really bizarre opportunities. I worked in a Japanese hair salon for 4 months, and that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I worked I enrobed chocolate truffles for a few months.
Uh-huh.
That was interesting, and I was able to live that way for a while. And every
did you
job
sorry
became,
did you did you get
project.
Did you get bored? Is that why were each of those 4 months?
No, because nobody, these were just, nobody really, people were interested in me and they were interested in being part of the project.
Mm.
So they were just short-term jobs. I mean, did the Japanese hair salon really need me? Not really, but mm-hmm. it wasn't a lot of money for them, and they enjoyed having me around, and it was like a really interesting and crazy experience doing that.
Right.
For me. So I stuck with it. I mean, I also, I'm not looking to work in a Japanese hair salon.
What about the truffle thing?
The truffle thing was interesting, but I gained 10 pounds.
You're eating all the non-successful truffles, the non-saleable?
I ate all the screw-ups.
Right. That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
Just
to go back to your comment, your poem, and the comments thereafter, me and a lot of people listening to this show are making a lot of art that is free, as it were. So as in work that is, a lot has been invested in it, but it is not being sold for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's unfortunately a reality. That's just a reality of being an artist, even if you're not in the art world proper like you.
I mean, I guess, yeah. I just got my... I'm 28. I've been able to live off my art for 5 years since graduating school. But like I said, I had to sacrifice a lot of comforts to do that. Sacrificed a lot of comforts. 7 months ago, I was offered this full-time job, a lot of money. And my mentor said, go to the belly of the beast, take the money, meet some people, and see what happens. It was the most miserable I've ever been. It was the most money I've ever made. It was the most miserable I've ever been. And I was let go about a month or two ago, and I filed for unemployment. But yeah, so I mean, it's just nothing is easy. when you're trying to do this kind of stuff.
What was the job?
I worked for this company, Mashable.
I've heard of that company.
I probably shouldn't comment. It was a pretty miserable experience for me.
Did you just sign a non-disclosure agreement?
No, I could comment. I mean,
well, why not?
They fired me, so.
Yeah, but I mean, you could just talk about what about it was miserable, exactly.
I, you know, going in, I was promised carte blanche. I was promised all of these opportunities, and you know, people got mad at me for leaving the office to take meetings. And that, I had a micromanager. I was mismanaged. I wasn't really able to stretch my, they hired me for my out-of-the-box thinking. And none of that, they didn't keep up their end of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
That was really hard for me. It was really hard for me to sit down all day. And I just couldn't. It was, they asked for one thing, and then they asked for something different once I got there.
Right.
And
they bait and switched you a little bit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
but
anyway,
just to, but if you don't mind my playing devil's advocate for just a second, since we're talking about
of course.
Being that you do have health issues related to staying in one place for extended periods, I mean, was that to some extent a non-starter, or was it, did they know that and they sort of didn't realize, oh, we can't have this after all, kind of thing?
No, they knew. I mean,
yeah.
I knew somebody up high who put in a good word for me, and everybody knew going in, this was my first real, like, job, my first 9-to-5. So they knew everything about me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want. Supposedly that's what they wanted. They wanted somebody to come in with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
But I came in with these fresh eyes, and they were rejected.
Well, it sounds like it was maybe, I mean, obviously I don't know what I'm talking about, but my suspicion is that it wasn't the fresh eyes they were rejecting. It was more that they couldn't handle a new person who was sort of acting like a, you know, a very freelance creative consultant, but they wanted you to be a full-time team player kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that sounds right too.
I'm not playing their sides. I'm just sort of trying to understand where they're coming from. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I think I thought they wanted one thing, and I think maybe it was miscommunicated what they really wanted.
Right.
And I just wasn't able to give it to them.
Yeah. Right. Right. So are you now sort of going from one kind of freelance creative consulting type of situation to another, or is it a little bit more
sort of
stern?
So, I mean, we're finishing up the film. You know, mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of money, so I saved a lot of money from the job, so I'm living off that now.
Mm-hmm.
We're finishing up the film, I'm taking meetings, and I'm hopefully going to go back to, or I'm going to go back to the larger freelance jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you're taking meetings, are you taking meetings about film projects or what?
Everything, brand, you know, some of the brand partnerships I did before,
mm-hmm.
with the kind of aesthetic that I've cultivated over the past few years.
Right.
I've got this one kind of, it started as a joke at an art show, and it became this bigger brand. So I'm looking to relaunch that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, really all my time and energy has really gone to this film at this point.
Sure.
My partner and I were working on a project in the same vein as Amazon Boy. So that will come out this fall. But that's not like a money thing.
That's coming out as in video form on YouTube? Or
No, it'll be a performance in the same vein as Amazon Boy.
In the city.
In the city, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
yeah.
You know, as you're describing your taking meetings, you know, and the projects. And I mean, certainly this,
mm-hmm.
this remaking of Annie Hall is a whole nother thing altogether, you know, but I guess I wonder if having your hand in a number of projects that, you know, without getting overly invested in semantics, do sort of exist in the advertising realm and also being an artist. And that's not, certainly not a new thing. You know, I mean, the first person that comes to mind is Marilyn Minter, the painter who does a lot of fashion type stuff that, you know, which her paintings reflect. But in your case, I'm just wondering if that murkiness is just the new norm of where we are, or, you know, if there's ever a point where integrity becomes an issue. Does that make sense?
For me, it's hard because I make it, you know, I've done the way I used to live. I would do 3 big projects each year and I would live off those projects. And it's been a while since I've made money off of any of my quote unquote like art or advertising projects. So it's hard for me to talk about that. Like it would be one thing if I was like making money off of it. Then I'd be like, sure, like we can talk about integrity. But right now, and like even in the past, I've made so little money from it that I feel like what I'm trying to do, if anything, is satirize whatever brand, like satirize advertising in general, satirize people's expectations of brands and advertising in general.
Mm-hmm.
That for me, it always comes down to humor and like I think my art. I guess that's why I call myself a conceptual comedian, because it boils down to entertainment and humor and satire. And so even when I'm doing these larger projects, I still think there's a lot more to it than just advertising, I guess.
Mm-hmm,
And like selling the project.
Yeah.
Amazon, for example, you know, I didn't make a dollar off the Amazon Boy project. That was me being and performing and making art. And I've done stuff with Pepto-Bismol and I didn't make a dollar off that. It wasn't with them. I just used them.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of use brands as jump off points and conduits to talk about bigger things.
Right.
I think, you know, there's so much out there, and, you know, with cell phones and computers, there's constant advertisements in your face all the time. So it's hard. I mean, again, I think it's really just me reacting to the amount of advertisements and advertising and brands that are being thrust at you constantly.
Yeah.
You know, you start dreaming of these things. So for me, it's using these brands and images and turning them on their head and tweaking them a little bit, and then regurgitating them, and then throwing them back out into the public and asking people to think about these brands a little differently.
Yeah. You reminded me of a point earlier in the conversation that I've neglected to follow up on, which was this guy Jordan. What's his last name again?
Sailor,
yeah.
He's incredible.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, do you think you could try to hook me up with him so that I maybe could get a universal key for Los Angeles? Because let me tell you,
he's incredible.
Yeah, as bad as you have it in New York, it might be even worse here in LA as far as disgusting billboards all over the place.
Yeah, maybe, probably. I mean, I know he has keys for California.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right. So it's a done deal. You'll connect us, and we'll see what happens. And I'll try not to get arrested.
Definitely.
Are you familiar with and/slash fan of Adbusters by any chance?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, I'm a fan.
Yeah,
I've bought in one issue and I've read a lot of issues at Whole Foods.
Right. Yeah, no, because I think that's a really important sort of reference, just as far as you talk about your launching point. You know, because I think I think when you talked much earlier in the conversation about how out of Amazon you got this sort of commercial gig, essentially, you know, that that you got paid for, I think somehow I got in my head that there was a certain amount of ambiguity along this spectrum of making an art project, making a commercial, and back and forth kind of thing. But the way you articulated using brands as sort of a starting point to do these projects, you know, made me think of Adbusters, and that
is very much a subversive form of, potentially subversive form of art making in itself.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm like, the irony is like, I wear the exact same thing every day. I wear no logos. The only logos I wear are the ones that I create, but they're all jokes anyway.
Right.
So it's, for me, I love making art with other people's brands and logos, but when it comes to myself, I just won't do it. I won't wear any logos. It's
right.
It's just monochromatic.
Right. So going back to the beginning of our conversation, your sugar daddy best friend roommate, who is a producer, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, are there any points where, even though he might not do it just because there would be a boundary issue, does he have opportunities in his work where he could hire you for something?
He, like I said, my skill set is so non-traditional that, you know, he's offered me so many things, but I just don't have the right skill set. He's constantly trying to help me out, and it's a slap in my face every time, because it's like, I just don't know how to do certain things.
Sure.
He hired me for a few months one time to do like basic assisting stuff, and that was fine. But like, where I thrive is in concept.
Yeah.
But when it comes to technical skills, it's just, I wasn't brought up with these. So
yeah, that's rough.
It's really rough.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's rough knowing that your sweet spot, that your expertise is in sort of concept development, if you will, and yet you obviously, the last thing you would want to do is be in a think tank at an advertising company, right? And yet there's no easy solution to making money producing art that way either.
It's not easy. I'm figuring it out still.
Yeah, and that's fine. You're doing fine. You're doing fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about you.
You know, I made a joke in the beginning, which I almost wish I didn't make, because, you know, I said I had self-doubt, and I think that's just like intrinsic to, you know, being a vulnerable artist. But it has to be balanced and coupled with an amount of confidence as well.
Right.
Because, you know, I don't paint, and I wish I did. It's something I wish I could paint or play an instrument so badly, because, you know, whatever's going on in your head or what you're feeling, you can express it instantaneously to some extent. And for me, it's when I get an idea, it might take me 3 months to get it off the ground, which is extremely frustrating. And I don't have this clear narrative or path in terms of, like, if I wanted to be a photographer, it's like, well, I can like look at what this photographer did from point A to point B to point C and it to some extent follow those steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that path as a painter or photographer or an actor per se. And not to say that that makes it any easier. I think it's hard no matter what you're trying to do. But for me, it's almost debilitating sometimes, because I have no idea what my next step is.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just continuing to make, my next step has always been just make the work, put it out there, see what happens, take meetings, meet people. And that's kind of what it is every time. But like, for example, it's like, I'm not going to, well, it's not going to, but it's a lot harder for me to like get in a group show, because what do I have to,
right?
What am I going to produce to get into that group show?
Right.
I've made a handful of quote unquote paintings, but they're awful. It's me forcing myself to do something that I don't really feel comfortable doing.
Right. Yeah.
Just for a little exposure in a show.
Sure. Well, group shows have videos all the time. So I don't think that's an insurmountable, angle. This was something I also had much earlier in the conversation. Has it ever been on the table to start up a YouTube channel, you know, where that becomes one of your forums?
Yeah, yes and no, because I don't even, like, I want to do more film, but I don't know what I would put on the YouTube channel.
Well, I mean, a perfect example is 2 minutes of footage of Amazon Boy walking around the streets, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah, the performance stuff. Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Okay.
I guess that's what the Instagram's for right now.
Right. Well, Matt,
that's
do you feel
idea.
Like how do you feel right now?
Good. I mean, I told you, I think when we first talked that this was going to be therapeutic for me. I'm in a weird transition right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first real opportunity I've had to talk about my art with someone in a really long time. So I feel good, but it's also just like I'm sure a lot of people listening, it's confusing and it's difficult and it's not easy. And even when I think I have the answer, it's not the answer for a really long time. It might be like immediate, and then I have to kind of rework that and tweak it a little bit.
Yeah.
But that being said, it's nice. I think it's important to talk about what you're doing just to keep yourself in check sometimes.
Yeah. And I wonder if because of the independence that you have, you know, as an artist, being in your own sort of particular niche, that I wonder if since you do have limited opportunities for conversation, when you are Amazon Boy or another performance that is yet to come or has already happened, maybe like that guy who was the actor who you had the conversation with, maybe there will inevitably be an artist or critic type of person who you will be able to get into an extended conversation with and like do a little street dialogue, as it were.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And there are some, but it's obviously not as many as I would like.
Sure. Well, I don't think that's particular to you. I think there are artists even in New York, as well as LA, as well as London, that probably do not feel as satisfied as they would like to with the community and regularity of dialogue about what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, I actually, to one more point, I don't think I'm alone at all. I did a project called Looking for Friends, and I put a call out there looking for new friends. And anybody who reached out, I would get coffee with, and I would talk with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is something that I constantly think about. And when I did this project, I realized I'm definitely not alone, because even people who had a great group of friends were still looking for something else.
Interesting. Wow. So what were those conversations like?
Incredible.
Yeah.
A lot of people felt really lonely. I talked to people who I normally wouldn't have had the opportunity to talk to.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, in the beginning, I would always buy the person coffee. That got really pricey, so I had to stop. But, you know, these were people who never would have spoken to me in college, who never would have spoken to me in high school. But they reached out, and it's not because of any sort of, like, Instagram following. They reached out because of the message and because of the opportunity. You know, I made myself vulnerable, and I said, listen, I'm looking for friends. You know, I have friends, but I'm looking to connect in ways that I haven't been recently. So please reach out, and if you're interested, I'll buy you a coffee. And I think I must have had 50 conversations.
That's awesome.
And that was just in real life. I must have had another 50 just over the phone.
Wow. That's
yeah,
awesome.
It was incredible.
I feel like I feel a little sad that that project has ended. Do you think I could convince you to revive it? Maybe?
So I think about that project all the time. People every now and then still reach out. So that's something kind of like Amazon Boy. It's a seasonal thing. It's probably, you know, it started in the winter. It was probably some seasonal depression stuff.
Sure.
Or seasonal lonely stuff. So
yeah,
so yeah, maybe. Yeah, I would love to revive that.
Come this November, you know, it's time to start.
Yeah.
Oiling up the
November
the advertisement. yeah, exactly. And maybe you could somehow hook up with a barista or what have you who can hook you up with some.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
There you go. All right. Well, I guess I will consider this sort of a somewhat of a version of one of the phone calls that you did for this project, but maybe I can sort of take a rain check for an actual one, because I'm kind of curious to hear what that would be like. All right, awesome. Well, Matt, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And this is really wonderful.
Absolutely.
It's a great opportunity.
You bet. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Matt for talking to me, for making himself vulnerable the way he did there. sharing all of that material. And Matt, I am holding you to two things. One, that you're going to do that phone call with me as part of your Making Friends project, and that you're going to connect me with Jordan Saylor, the Keys to the City, the bus stop guys, so I can do my own guerrilla art here in Los Angeles, okay? And you guys follow up with me, so we hold him to it, right? Great. Thank you guys for being here. Before we jump into the story about the one percenter and his art and the move, which I definitely want you guys to stick around for, yeah, this is a listener-supported show. Guess what? We do not have advertising on this show currently. We may never have advertising on this show. So the way that we support ourselves, or I should say we get a little financial assistance, is from you guys. And I wanted to remind you of that and ask politely for your donation. You can donate to the show either via PayPal or Patreon, which Patreon you can support the show for as little as $1 a month. If you start at $3 or more a month, you will be eligible for bonus material. So I encourage you to start at $3, even $5 a month would be fantastic. We've only had an ad or two in the Patreon department in the last couple of months, so would love to get some more of you on there. Keep the show going. A PayPal donation would be great as well. It's been a slow August in that department. It was a much better July. So I'm hoping for, you know, in the neighborhood of 10 or so donations this September, perhaps more. So would love it if you guys could come on board for that. And here are a couple of reasons why. One, if you want something out of it, in addition to maybe some bonus episodes, I still have some of the Kate McQuillan Night Sky Home poster project that she did. And so if you make a donation of $25 or more, I can send you one of those if you're interested. But here's an even perhaps better reason. I could use some new microphones for the show, at least one, but even a couple more for multiple person in-person recordings would be fantastic. Here's why. I was doing a little troubleshooting for my mixer, which is a Pro FX8, a USB-based mixer. And the tech support guy who was talking to me, I told him the setup, and he said, oh, you should probably try these couple of microphones. They'll be a lot better. They'll get rid of the plosives and so on. And I think they're in the neighborhood of $150 per, something like that, maybe a little bit more. So that's where your money would be going if you would be so kind as to donate. Get us some new microphones. It's been since 2013 that I purchased these microphones. So it probably is time for an upgrade, wouldn't you say? So I ask you very, very sweetly and kindly for financial support of whatever you can afford would be very much appreciated, especially if you listen to the show regularly and enjoy it. It would be very much appreciated. You can also support this show by leaving a nice review on iTunes and or Stitcher. The iTunes one is linked through the website. You can, of course, follow on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And if you are interested in hearing me on another podcast, recommend me to another podcast, and we'll make that happen. I'd be interested to see where that goes if that ever does happen. So thank you in advance for your support of the show. Let's jump over to the reading of the one percenter and his art anecdote. And let me just tell you where this originated. I was listening to the author interviewed on the Leonard Lopate Show, a show I've mentioned before, and he does long-haul moving. He does moving of high-end VIP people. Moving is primarily what he's doing these days. And he mentioned how he works with a crew that is of, you know, obviously of a lower economic bracket, and then he works with the clients, aka the shippers, of a higher, obviously, very high economic bracket. So he's got the platform to look at the sort of income divide. That's not how he put it, but that's how I would put it. And I'm fascinated by that. So that is what led me to the book. And now that is what is leading to this anecdote. Okay, before I read this passage, let me just set it up real quick. It's from the book called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road by Finn Murphy. It's from this year, and it is a memoir. And in this passage, a couple things you need to know. One is that, of course, Finn is talking as the narrator, and he refers at one point to the shipper, which is an industry term for the client, the customer, the person who is having their move done. And additionally, at one point, Finn is talking with one of his helpers, Eduardo, and it might be a little bit confusing, but it shouldn't be too bad. I'm not going to identify them. You're just going to have to pick it up from the tone. All right, with all that explained, let's dive in. It's page 154, in case you haven't and you want to follow along. I picked up an ex-investment banker with his $3 million worth of loot going to Aspen. My regulars, Julio and Carlos, and another helper I use regularly named Eduardo, drove out from Denver, so I had my A-team crew. My shipper, after helping topple his bank in 2008, caught another plum job with another troubled public company that was paying for this move. Without getting all Eugene Debs about it, it seems to me that while many bad movers end up in orange vests picking up trash on roadsides, many bad executives get new million-dollar jobs running other companies into the courtroom. I rolled into Aspen and parked at the Bavarian Motel. I had called previously to ask if they could accommodate my truck, and the desk clerk said he'd arrange it. He also told me the trucker rate was $149 a night, a huge bargain for Aspen. I booked one room for me and one for the lumpers. When I pulled up next to the motel, I saw a 100-foot row of orange road cones the desk clerk had put out to save the spaces for me. I was snug on South Mill Street in downtown Aspen with a tractor trailer right across the street from the Grand Hyatt. Unbelievable. The boys met me in the lobby about 8 p.m., and we ordered a pizza. They asked to talk to the delivery guy in person, saying that they had to give him directions. They negotiated a pickup of a 12-pack of Coronas with him and sat by the pool smoking cigarettes until he arrived. I grabbed a slice and a Corona and went to my room to fill out my logbook and go to sleep. At 7 a.m., we headed out to the residence. We got through the security gate, found the shipper's house, and prepared to unload. I knocked on the door, which was answered by a middle-aged Latina. She let me in and led me through the entryway, into one of the living rooms, across the art gallery, and into the chef's kitchen with the stainless Sub-Zero and the granite island, each stone no doubt manually shaped by Lake Como virgins using nail files. 50 grand worth of copper pots that could have served lunch for the Army of the Potomac hung on hooks above the island. I won't go into any further detail about what amenities a $25 million starter castle in Aspen has, except to mention the 8 bedrooms, the 11 bathrooms, and the Olympic-sized pool in the basement. It was an older house, maybe almost a decade old, so it was regrettably missing some key necessities for a 21st century one percenter, i.e., the home theater, the wine cellar, and the Sonos Bluetooth sound system. I stood there at the kitchen entrance for a few moments and watched my shipper in a deep huddle with a woman and another man. The shipper was a short man with graying auburn hair, about 45 years old. The woman, his new wife, was a statuesque blonde about 30, and the other guy, the builder, was a tall, slim man wearing a starched shirt with French cuffs. They were talking wine cellars. I stood there a while longer and then emitted a delicate, Jeeves-like cough to announce my presence. The shipper, let's call him Mr. Big, looked over at me and said to the builder guy, "I'll be right back. I need to deal with this." Mr. Big ambled over. I introduced myself, gave my radiant road driver smile, handed him my card, and put out my hand to shake, and said we were here to move his stuff in. "Okay," he said, ignoring my hand. "I'm kind of busy. Consuelo can tell you where everything goes. Do you need anything from me?" "No, sir. It will take us a bit of time to prep the house. We'll cover the white carpets and pad the walls. Is there anything you need from me?" "I don't think so. How long do you think you'll be here?" "Well, sir, there's quite a bit of stuff and a lot of uncrating. We'll be here until 5 or so." "That long? Can't you move faster?" "I've got my best crew in from Denver, sir. We won't waste time, but we do like to do things properly, and properly will take us to 5 o'clock." "Fine. Deal with Consuelo. By the way, if you'll be here all day, will you guys need to use a bathroom?" "Probably, sir. The normal procedure is to designate a guest or staff bathroom for the crew. We have our own cleaning supplies, and we'll make sure it's shipshape before we leave. Well, that's not going to work. You see, my wife, sir, I have 3 handpicked men and myself. We do VIP corporate moves all the time. We'll be respectful, but we are required to answer the call of nature. Can't you go down to the security shed? Well, I suppose we could, but that would mean moving the truck 2 miles each time. That will take the job into tomorrow. Tell you what, across the street they're putting in my tennis court. They have a porta potty there. Use that. Yes, sir, we'll use that. Okay then, we're done here. He turned away to talk wine cellars, tennis courts, and home theater. We prepped the house and started unloading. In addition to a bunch of cartons and some rolled rugs, there were 25 crates holding 8 600-pound pieces of granite and 17 art canvases. For VIP moves like this, we're authorized to uncrate everything and set it where it's supposed to go. We'll do everything except hang pictures on the wall. We finished unloading around noon. We worked fine with Consuelo. She spoke no English, but both Julio and Eduardo speak Spanish. Eduardo grew up in Longmont, Colorado, but spent 5 years as a pimp in Juarez. At noontime, the shipper's threesome disappeared. They returned an hour later with a bunch of bags from the deli downtown and proceeded to set up luncheon at the Granite Island. I eased into the kitchen to tell Mr. Big we'd completed unloading and would take a short break before commencing the uncrating. He took a long bite out of his hoagie and said, "Fine." I looked at all the food bags, sort of waiting. We don't expect to be fed by our shippers, but when the nearest deli is 30 minutes down valley and I had spent 20 minutes backing my rig down the winding driveway, it would have been thoughtful to ask the movers if they wanted anything from town. Not Mr. Big. There would be no luncheon provided for the proles. I went back to the truck and told the boys we'd be skipping lunch. Eduardo looked at me and said, "Maybe it's time to throw your weight around." Throw my weight around? Throw your weight around. You've never heard the term before? Meaning what exactly, Eduardo? Meaning we're brown guys and you're the white guy. To throw your weight around means you're supposed to fix the situation with your pale-faced amigo. I've never heard the term throw your weight around, but I like it. Problem is, I'm not white enough to throw anything around with this guy. We're already pissing in the porta potty. We're already starving. Do you think this guy looks at me any different from you? I guess he doesn't. How do you like being a brown guy? Just then, Carlos came to the truck. He looked at me and winked. Let's get this fucker done. I'll start unpacking boxes. Julio, hand me your knife. Julio put up his hands. No knife. Eduardo, let me borrow your knife. Eduardo shrugged. No knife. How about that? Said Carlos. 3 Mexicans and no knife. Everyone laughed and the tension was broken. Carlos figured that since we'd have the Bavarian Motel for another night, we'd hit Aspen later and gorge ourselves. He told me his cousin said we needed to go to the Hickory House for ribs and order the 2-person, $72 feast from the menu. Carlos said that if we added a bucket of Modelos to the rib platter, it might go a long way toward dealing with the day. I told him that sounded like an excellent plan. Carlos smiled and became the happiest man on earth as he humped the crates while his tummy was rumbling, knowing that a feast at the Hickory was going to end his day. I envied his attitude. The nice thing about hard work is that it eventually ends. When it ends, there's a hot shower, sore muscles, and, if you're lucky, a few cold Modelos and a pile of ribs. That's enough for Carlos and very often for me. Eduardo, on the other hand, hadn't yet finished his personal Occupy movement. I ask you a question, he said. How do you like being a brown guy? I'm okay with it mostly, Eduardo. If I let it get to me, then I'd be pissed off like you. The shipper doesn't know me or you, and he doesn't care to. It's not really about us. We're just pieces of the machine to get his art uncrated. Well, it pisses me off. He's treating us like dirt, and you can't change it. There's going to come a time when I'm going to get really pissed off at both of those things. Your problem, Eduardo, is that you can't stand being a mover. You think you're cut out for better things. You've got a certain dignity that you're not able to release. You're in the wrong business. Look at Carlos. He doesn't let this stuff bother him. Carlos is an idiot. At least when I was a pimp, I could keep my dignity. Carlos looks brilliant to me. He takes what he's given and smiles through it all. I wish I could be that smart. So you were a dignified pimp? Look at what you had to do with your girls. You could keep your dignity, but they couldn't keep theirs. They didn't have any. You sound just like our shipper. Do you think he's better off being on top of the pile and you're worse off being at the bottom? What is it you want? I think you want to be over there discussing wine cellars and treating the rest of us like dirt. You're exactly right. That should be me over there. Remind me never to move you when your ship comes in, Eduardo. How about we get this job done and go and eat some ribs and drink some beer? That's enough for Carlos, maybe even for you. Not for me. You're just playing at this shit anyway. Mr. Great White Mover with a house in Boulder, slumming with the brown guys for some kicks. That pisses me off too. I should kick your ass. It's not that much of a game humping furniture and being treated like I'm invisible. I do the same work as you, and I drive and I do the paperwork. Ever read Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison? I'm not much of a reader. Too bad, you'd like it, but it would piss you off even more. I don't need that. No, you don't. Still, it can be a comfort to know you're not the only one annoyed at the status quo. I couldn't care less who else out there is getting disrespected. I only care about me getting disrespected. You like this work. I fucking hate it. Eduardo, my doing this has nothing to do with you. But you're right, I do like it. If it was all you had, you'd hate it. There might be some truth to that. Let's finish this and eat some ribs. You can't buy me off like Carlos with some fucking ribs. I'm not trying to buy you off. I'm simply asking you to enjoy the ribs with me and Julio and Carlos. Do you want to kick my ass afterwards? Fine. It won't change your circumstances and it won't quell your anger. Maybe afterward I won't be so angry. Do you really think that? No. But I really do think I need to release all this anger at somebody. I've got an idea. How about we fuck the shipper? How? Leave that to me. I'll get him where it hurts. Right smack in the center of that bloated ego of his. I promise you it will be good. That might get me through the day, but I still want to hurt somebody. I'm going to tell Consuelo that this house is famous for a murder and that it's haunted. She's the kind of Latina I think she is. She'll be gone by 5. Maybe we should invite her for ribs. Let's go back to work. Julio and Carlos missed this little existential conversation. They were working. They had definitely not missed the scene at the kitchen island with all the food, though. They're more used to this than I am. Brown guys in Colorado don't get a lot of respect. On the other hand, they could have shopped yesterday for today's lunch instead of drinking beer at the motel pool. But that would have taken foresight, which none of my guys have in abundance. For my part, I generally don't eat at all when I'm working, so I don't think of their lunch. Well, I'm not their babysitter. We attacked the crates. The 8 granite pieces we wheeled in were gravestones from Chinese emperors. Mr. Big told us to be careful since each one cost $85,000. He had 8 pedestals custom built in his gallery to showcase them. Before I dropped out of my chic Northeastern liberal arts college, I took Chinese for 1 semester. I was there just long enough to learn some rudimentary characters. I knew the Chinese reads from right to left, and I knew the vertical orientation. I was damn sure Mr. Big didn't know Chinese from Pig Latin, so I had the boys set up the slabs upside down. Sooner or later, Mr. Big would have a cocktail party and be bragging about his pilfered gravestones to somebody who knew Chinese. He didn't care about the movers, but he would care about being exposed as an ignorant Philistine when it was pointed out he doesn't know up from down on his 600 grand worth of stolen rock. It wasn't a big victory, but down there on the moving trucks, it was enough. We finished the job. No tip, naturally. After showers at the motel, we took a cab to Hickory's and ordered 2 feasts. That's when I told them about the gravestones. They all laughed their asses off, even Eduardo. Just as we were leaving, Consuelo came in with her husband and 3 kids. Eduardo had told her the gringo driver would buy her family dinner. Eduardo knew I would, of course. I shook my hands with Mr. Consuelo, nodded at the children, and left my credit card number with the hostess. I don't know any Spanish, but when I was walking out the door to the taxi, a little bit buzzed on 6 or 9 Modelos, I saw Consuelo cross herself several times in front of Eduardo. On the way home, Eduardo told us Consuelo had quit. She told him she knew there was something wrong with the house and the occupants, but hadn't figured it out until Eduardo told her about the murder. And scene. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that. It certainly was a lot to do, wasn't it? There's just so much to make you mad out there that's going on, and this certainly was at least a charming version of something infuriating that's happening with the one percenters. And there's an article in the New Yorker right now on Carl Icahn, who is a world-class asshole, in case you didn't know. So it's all it's obviously reaching a boiling point, as we all well know. But anyway, all that said, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Matt. Thank you guys so much again for being here. And let us know what you think. Let us know what you thought of my reading. And the phone is ringing off the hook from Audible for me to be reading all sorts of fantasy books and memoirs and so on. So, yeah, I'm going to be quitting my day job and doing that. Don't worry. Yes, that was sarcasm. And one last thing for those of you who have stuck around this long, thank you for doing so. If you are interested in representing the podcast as a sales agent to be paid on commission for any work procured, or you know somebody who might be interested, do get in touch with me via the Conversation Art Podcast at Gmail, and we can talk more. Okay, thank you in advance, and I look forward to hearing from you. I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Be well. Enjoy the slew of openings, and I will talk to you then. Ciao for now.